the very sense that the incarnate Son of God spent the vast majority of his time as a carpenter on planet Earth should tell you and me that being human and doing sometimes very common labor honors God because Jesus did it.
Hello, and welcome to Working with me, Dan Doriani, hosting a podcast where we explore faith, work, culture, and the way believers can make a difference in their corner of the world. Today's guest is Tom Nelson, president of the Faith and Work organization, Made to Flourish. He's a pastor and the author of several books, including Work That Matters, The Economics of Neighborly Love, and most recently, The Flourishing Pastor. I'm excited to have Tom with us today because of his insights into the world of faith and work. He's had a lifelong desire to bridge what he calls the Sunday to Monday gap. Today's guest is Tom Nelson, who is about as good a friend as you can have with some friendship you can have with someone who you see once a year and you share a meal with once in a while. But I've always enjoyed the times when we've chatted, Tom. Tom Nelson is a large or really very large church pastor in the Kansas City area. The church is Christ Community. It's E-Free. He's written a number of books. We're going to focus on three of them tonight. And we're also going to talk about his personal history and how that shaped the books he wrote, Work Matters, The Economics of Neighborly Love, and then most recently, a book about leadership. Say a little bit more about yourself, Tom. Introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yeah, Dan, I feel the same way about you. I mean, you know, we don't get to see each other real often, but it's always so sweet to have time with you. I grew up in Minnesota. I'm a Minnesota kid. A very long time ago. Six or seven kids, big family. And I am married to a beautiful lady named Liz. We will celebrate our 40th anniversary this May. And I always tell people she is a woman of great long suffering.
Yeah.
She's put up with me a long time, but no, she's really awesome. I have two grown kids. One's married and one's not. One lives in the Bay Area near San Francisco. The other lives in Kansas City. And probably the most important thing to know is that we have a big dog. His name's Harley. He's a 100-pound golden doodle, and we're empty nesters with no grandchildren, so he gets doted on all the time.
All right. That sounds like fun. Tom, one of the wonderful things about your work is the way you interweave your personal story with your theology. And I do sincerely believe God's given you a gift of reflecting on your experience in a way that helps motivate people and see points that you want to make. So one of the things you discuss in a couple places, actually, I think I saw it most poignantly in your 2017 book, The Economics of Neighborly Love. You grew up in probably an impoverished childhood, not kind of poor, but actually poor. And your father died when you were a child and left your mother with several young children, very limited income. And you were a member of a church, and the church seemed kind of oblivious to, you know, peeling paint on your house and other signs of need. And that experience moved you. You've reflected on that at length. Tell us what you learned from growing up poor and the church not exactly noticing. How has that shaped your ministry and your writing?
Yeah, I think all of us, Dan, are so shaped by our past and often by the difficulties, right? Or things we find in failure, God uses that. I often quote Soren Kierkegaard because I literally love him. But he said, we live our life forward and we understand it backward. And so I think as I'm getting a little older, I have a better understanding in God's sovereignty, of God's training for me. And a big part of that was facing death early, losing my dad, which has always been a vacuum and gap in my life. I've always had an empty chair, which has shaped me, sometimes misshaped me. But I think growing up in a single-parent home that was a godly home, and I want to say that I had economic impoverishment, but I had spiritual riches and had intellectual riches. So two out of the three I had in my home, but our economic situation was very dire. After my dad died, my mom went to work in a very menial kind of job, and we were a part of a church, a vital part of a church. We were there every Sunday. But there was a real massive gap between Sunday and Monday in our church's thinking, its theology. And I guess I felt that really personally as a young kid. And many of the things that I experienced, what it meant to be really, really poor and to feel the stares of other children. I still remember getting on the bus one morning when someone looked at me and said, when are you going to paint your house? And imagine as a young boy, that's devastating. So that profoundly impacted me at a young age.
In the book, you say, actually, you say it in two of your books, I realized at an early age that I live in an economic world, which doesn't mean economics dominated your world. As you just said, you had two blessings of the great issues of life, intellectual, spiritual, and economic. You had two of the three. Praise God, they're the best two to have. But you learned you live in an economic world. What does that mean? Speak to other spiritually minded people.
Yeah, well, it took me a while to develop that, Dan. I mean, I realized on a very personal, experiential level, I mean, when you go to a store and you don't have money to buy food, or you deal with your clothes that you don't have money to get new clothes and ragged clothes and how people accept you and how you navigate life, you realize that how that economic reality that you're a part of as even a young boy profoundly places you in society, because society is deeply ordered around economic realities. Economics is simply means of exchange, how we exchange value with one another. I grew up very early understanding that economics profoundly shaped every day of what we did, what we planned for. Like, I never went on a vacation. I didn't know what a vacation was like. So I'm just saying, if you live in a more affluent context, you probably take it for granted.
Yes.
You have the resources to do just anything you want to do. But if you don't, then everything you do, everything you think about, relationships, friendships, you are stratified based on your economic reality. So we function deeply in an economic world.
Well, I'll just say I resonate with your story because I grew up in probably an environment you could best call very low middle class.
Okay.
Not poor, but very similarly, I never took a vacation except going to visit grandma and grandpa, on their farm. And that was vacation. That's what I understood. And similarly, there wasn't always money to buy clothes, at least not every year. Some years there was, some years there wasn't. Economics is, economics, classically speaking, is production, consumption, and also distribution. And that's what gets neglected. That's what you talk about in your books in several ways. You reflect on this in one of your writings in chapter 9 of the pastoral book. You said you had to confess to pastoral malpractice for failing to connect Sunday and Monday. Why is that malpractice? What did you mean by that? Very bold of you to say it.
Well,
what does it mean?
There's a lot behind that. It is a bit provocative, I would say, very provocative. But I think a couple things. One, let's go back to my childhood briefly. I grew up in a very strong pietistic Christian home. It had great discontinuity between the now and the then. And, Christian faith has always wrestled with the now and the then, right? How much is contiguous to the future? How much is not? But I grew up in a context where really the Christian faith, the gospel as we understood it, was a bit reductionistic. And that was, it got us to heaven. It was focused on this next world, but had very little to do with how we live in this world, apart from ethics. So I had a massive Sunday to Monday gap. I was taught that my Monday world didn't really matter that much. And you can imagine, it was really about just souls. I mean, I'm passionate about souls. They matter, right?
Right.
And just getting to heaven. But that was my theology that I grew up with and I was taught. And that profoundly malformed me. That's part of the reason why my family was so neglected by the church and their economic needs. So it wasn't that important, right? We were all about getting to heaven and being holy. So I carried that with me once I got through seminary and started as a pastor, Dan. And I had to come to the grips that my theology was off here, that I didn't look enough at what I call the bookends of the Holy Scriptures. When I really did my work in the early chapters of Genesis and the end of Revelation, I go, oh my goodness, my theology is impoverished. And because my theology was impoverished about this world and the new heavens and new earth and how this world does matter, when I got to be a pastor, then I realized my paradigm of pastoring was off. So all to say is that I was much more concerned about how well I did on Sunday than how my parish did on Monday. I took Ephesians 4 and I made it completely reductionistic. Like, I'm to equip them for the work of service. That meant inside the church,
right,
rather than the world. So yeah. I had to come to grips with my impoverished theology, Dan. I'm very charitable to those who trained me. I'm sorry, it's probably me, but I missed some things. And when I got my theology more in line, Then it reshaped my paradigm. It reshaped my pastoring. And I literally stood before my congregation. Most of my work was in Torah because I love Hebrew and Old Testament. So I had literally said to my congregation, I failed you. Now you kind of heard a pin drop, right? Mm-hmm. Because often when pastors make a confession, it's around financial malfeasance, right? Or moral issues. But I just said, God has called me to equip you for the works of service. And I've not been doing that.
Yes, you've been service in the church is what you equip them for, but not service to society, to the world, yes. To their neighbors.
Yes, and it gets me pretty animated because then I said, you know, I transparently, y'all, I've been much more concerned how well I did on Sunday than how well you did on Monday. And that is going to change. And that really changed the trajectory of our ministry, much of my writing, and continues to shape much of what we do with Made to Flourish.
Yeah, so one of the things I try to tell people, but in God's providence, I've known a number of people who are in the construction industry.
Yeah.
And design and architects and so forth. And I exhort them as they put up a building to think to themselves, you are loving people who may live, who may be unborn and who may work in this building in 120 years or 90 years. And these people are your neighbors, although you'll never meet them. They're your neighbors because your work touches their work. And lawyers, similarly, the goal is not to win the case in front of you. It's to help get good case law. And, you know, when a lawyer argues a significant case, say a religious freedom case, you're not defending your client. You're defending a very large number of people who are going to be in somewhat similar situations.
Yeah, indeed. And if you have a very discontinuous idea of eschatology,
yes,
this is what happens, at least where I grew up, is that this world really doesn't matter. I mean, yeah, if you're a lawyer, you're doing that because you got to have like a paycheck. But if you're really serious, you'd be a pastor or missionary because that's the only thing that really matters.
But if you're a good lawyer, you can earn a lot of money and support missionaries.
But see, that misses the theology as well. It's utilitarian, but that's often common rather than the very work we do. You know, I've said in different places, if we have a Sunday to Monday gap, then think of what that means. If we teach a reductionistic theology that does not understand how the gospel speaks into every nook and cranny of everyday life now, and it's not just going to heaven, it's bringing heaven to earth, right? The new heavens and earth. If we get that off, five things take place that are profoundly malforming. One is, think about this. When our congregations, if they think that worship is only what they do on Sunday, right? God designed us to worship in 24/7 with everything we are, everything we do, every relationship. So if we do have a Sunday to Monday gap in our preaching and our teaching and our thinking, then the worship of God is hindered. I mean, 24/7.
It's impoverished.
Right? I mean,
if you don't
it's incredible.
Get that right.
So what's at stake here? I know you've written on work too, but like what's at stake is the worship of God. Secondly, what's at stake is spiritual formation, because a primary place where Christ forms us, we're sanctified, is in the work we're called to do every day, right? Through suffering, through all kinds of things. But not only that, think of this. The plausibility of the gospel is at stake because the vast majority of our people today are going to encounter the non-believer in their workplace. And the gospel often needs to be seen before it's heard, but it's also heard through gospel proclamation. So, and the common good, think of all that's at the stake if people don't understand they are on mission for the glory of God every Monday. But many, many, many pastors have a Sunday to Monday gap. And that's what we're trying to narrow. I certainly did for a long time.
Yeah. And I'll just say, blessedly, I became a Christian in college. And happened to go to a Christian college, although I wasn't a Christian when I got there. And I heard, you know, the theme of work matters from, I don't know, a month into my Christian life. So I count myself blessed.
You are blessed.
In that regard. So there's a part of me that, you know, that says, looks at a book like Work Matters, and people use the phrase Work Matters, and think, well, how on earth could you think it doesn't matter? What is your problem? And of course, the answer is, that there are reasons why people think their work doesn't matter, and that is, I mean, to be bald about it, some work actually doesn't matter. I mean, if you're marketing lotteries, that's work that doesn't matter, except maybe in a negative way. Or if you're involved in marketing supplements that don't actually help people, that matters only negatively. And once in a while, do you agree that once in a while you have to tell people, I've done it, maybe you think I'm crazy, I've told people, you know what, the reason why you're dissatisfied with your work is because it's terrible work that you shouldn't be doing. You need to find a new job.
Well, I think that's fair if you have a relationship with them. I think it goes
yes,
back.
These aren't people that I just walk up to on the street, right? These are These are people that are telling me about their work problems.
Yeah.
And I said, so of course you have problems. You're in a terrible industry and you're doing it poorly.
Yes. I mean, there's several things I'd like to say on that. One is we have to define work fundamentally as contribution, not compensation. So when I unpack the Genesis text, from cradle to grave, we are called to contribute to God and to others. So contribution. And how do you define contribution? Contribution and compensation aren't always equated. So first of all,
Can we just make sure everybody hears that? Contribution and compensation are often misaligned.
Yes.
You can be paid very well for things like beating people up in public. That's known as boxing in MMA. And you're actually not contributing to the good of your neighbor, probably.
Right.
I'm taking a stand here. And so it's aligned very closely at times and very poorly at times, like a elementary school teacher or a nurse.
Yeah.
So
from cradle to grave, we're called to contribute, right, Dan? I mean, that's what I want to get. And then in many cultural contexts, the only thing I would just push back a little bit is that many people do not have many options what kind of work they do. Now, remember Martin Luther in his day said there were two things that were out of bounds, what I remember reading Martin Luther, right? Banking, because of usury, and prostitution. So yes, I think there are some things that are out of bounds, and it's sometimes it gets a little bit ethically squishy. I was speaking to a group of wonderful engineers in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Dan, several years ago. You know, Los Alamos is right there, and they have they were brilliant engineers, and they love Christ. And they'd come up to me after the talk and say, man, I'm making nuclear weapons. When does a weapon become immoral?
Yes.
I mean, there are obviously deep ethical complexities. Some are probably easier than others to say, hey, that work doesn't really much matter. Can you find something else to do? I don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously what we have to do is work hard. I mean, I know somebody, one of my best friends has worked all his life on F-15 fighters.
Yeah.
And he's a dedicated Christian. He got a seminary degree just because he felt like it. And he says, look, offensive weapons in my country are put to defensive uses, and we have enemies. We got to prepare ourselves to defend our borders. That's his view. So I think we have to say things like most work really does matter, like collecting garbage, sweeping floors, mopping floors.
Yeah.
It's not just work that matters. It's beautiful work. It's excellent work. But there is work that is, you know, corrupt or deceptive, let's say, no matter how much money you get.
Yeah. And I think there's more and more of a movement in a free market to have a triple bottom line or whatever triple bottom lines that in a workplace, if we have the power, right, organizational power, that we have at least three bottom lines, not just profit.
Right.
We have different stakeholders, right? The economy as a whole, the stakeholders, the climate, and people that we serve. So, yeah, there are multiple factors to consider in work. And one is it's more than just one bottom line.
Right. The common good, as you said. A minute ago. So it seems that you and I agree that you have to say your work matters a lot more than we wish we had to. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair.
And so we say it. We tell it to people over and over, and they go, oh, I never thought of it that way. How do you convey it to somebody who really isn't convinced? No, I'm just earning a living, and by the way, I've made a good amount of money, and I tie to the church. How do you convince a person who's making, you know, shampoo, let's say, that their work matters?
I think I would go to Jesus, and I would go right away to say, Jesus spent a lot of time, we say carpenter, I think he's a carpenter, tectone, but think about the Son of God spending 30 of the 33 years of his life doing a lot of grunt work. I mean, let's just face it. I mean, he sweats, he dealt with difficult things. I'm just saying, so I think Jesus modeled the very sense that the incarnate Son of God spent the vast majority of his time as a carpenter on planet Earth should tell you and me that being human within those finite limits we have and doing sometimes very common labor honors God because Jesus did it. That's one of the things I would encourage him.
Well, and also all of his parables are full of images about work, you know, shepherds and farmers and plowing fields and harvesting things. Yeah.
So that's where I would go, at least one thing.
This podcast is a production of the Center of Faith and Work in partnership with the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. If you're enjoying this conversation, you know the drill. Please rate this podcast and subscribe to it. and visit our workingwithdan.org site to get updates on new episodes, explore old episodes, hear clips from lectures on work, and enter to win our giveaways. Before we return to our conversation with Tom, let me send you to Tom's most recent book, The Flourishing Pastor. It offers a framework for ministry leaders to escape the burden and stress and crisis of their life. Of course, only a few of you are pastors or on church staff, but the issues of overcommitment, burnout, and accountability are universal. So, who are you leading? Who is leading you? As you listen, consider how you can flourish as a leader. So let's talk about your most recent book about leadership. And I told you in advance I want to talk about four chapters, 1, okay. 5, 9, and 11, and you said that was okay. So the first thing you say about leadership is that it's very important to be accountable. And we live in a tragic era, as you say in the book, with quite a few failed Christian leaders who are all too often too painfully in the news. Mars Hill, people saw it coming. They couldn't seem to get it to stop. They couldn't stop the train wreck before it occurred. Of course, TV ministries.
Yeah.
Ministries where you have to raise a lot of money that create the wrong kind of economic pressures. There are pastors who live a double life. You talk about that in a book. Some very famous people who are found to have lived a double life. I want to ask a follow-up question, but what would you say if you had 5 minutes with a group of pastors? How do you build accountability in your life so you're a good leader and you beautifully talk about finishing well and living well and dying well? How do you build accountability, and what would you say to a group of young pastors or seminarians?
I think, first of all, you know, what I would say, Dan, is that, you know, we talk a lot about sheep getting lost.
Yes.
But we don't spend a lot of time understanding that shepherds get lost and the significance of getting lost as a shepherd. So I would probably start, because accountability in my mind flows out of living before an audience of one. I mean, living, serving, the audience of one piece is such a formative aspect. But I would say that accountability means, first of all, that you live before an audience of one. And secondly, that everyone who leads well is well led. You're always being led, first by the good shepherd and led by a group of other people. You're never isolated. So in the first part of the book, I talk about it's a paradigm problem. The whole book is built on one verse. I've never written a book on one verse, because this verse has been so formative in my thinking for 35 years, and it's Psalm 78:72. And this is the verse I would give a group of pastors. So David shepherded them. Interesting, David, right? Psalm 78. So David shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with skillful hands. And we could spend the whole time
Say that again. Let everybody hear it. Say it again real slowly with, you know, drama.
Yes. Okay. So in Psalm 78:72, I think it's the primary leadership paradigm and verse of the whole scriptures. So David shepherded them. Notice this is the paradigm of shepherding. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart, and he guided them with skillful hands. So these two Hebrew phrases, tom lev and toben ayod, integrity of heart and skillful hands, frame the leadership paradigm of the Bible. And notice the progression. One is a paradigm of a shepherd. So in the first part of the book, I address the perilous paradigms, and there are many of them. If it's like having a north setting. If you get off early on in your pastoral life, if your north setting is off, you will not end up any place in a good place, right? So I talk about some of the most perils. One is the Lone Ranger, doing it on your own. I mean, that's really brutal. The visionary leader, I'm a little contrarian there. We can unpack more of that, but I think there's some really dangerous with visionary leadership. Bonhoeffer was right, I think.
By visionary leader, you mean the person who has a vision but maybe doesn't want to put the effort into implementing and has a vision?
It's more culturally encoded than that. When I think of vision, I think of someone who says, in 10 years, we're going to be this.
Right.
Usually it's bigger.
Right.
And it's not necessarily God's vision. It's not a vision of the kingdom. It's not a vision of the scriptures.
It's the bad kind of visionary. I've got a vision.
Yeah.
We're all in favor of vision, of course, godly vision.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
So this paradigm of the visionary or celebrity or Lone Ranger impact is perilous. So if you start out pastoring with the wrong paradigm of what your calling is, then you're going to go off the rails in time. You really are. The second thing is you're not increasingly formed. Right, so integrity of heart, it deals with the formation of one's inner world, that we live and breathe and serve and love out of the overflow of who we are and who we're becoming. Dallas Willard used to say it all the time, It's not just what you do, it's who you're becoming. And, right. and I would say to the pastors, number one, it's who you are becoming much more than what you are doing. And then the skillful hand piece, I unpack that. But really, the Hebrew idea is an artistry, is an artist's hands of a shepherd. So I would say, number one, if I were talking to a group of pastors, I would say you need to cultivate the presence of your good shepherd every day. I think Psalm 23 is one of the greatest leadership texts ever. And you need to follow him really well. And as you learn to follow well, you will learn to lead well. And you do it in community. You do it before an audience of one. And you continually strive in grace, in the gospel, in the power of the Spirit, to become more and more an apprentice of Jesus. And then you will lead out of the overflow of who you are.
I love that. And to say a very hearty amen, I couldn't agree more if I tried. The way we go off the rails, I think... celebrity pastors, visionary pastors maybe are more inclined to have a crash, and maybe the Lone Rangers are more likely to be crushed.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
Is that fair?
Very good way to say it.
You, in chapter 5, talk a significant amount about the need for apprenticeship. And, of course, you cite that one of the core texts that we look to in the Gospels, Luke chapter 6, verse 40, which says, "Everyone, when fully trained, will be like his teacher." Jesus actually says that four times. He says it in Matthew one way, he says it in Luke, he says it twice in John, as you know. And he, and the wording's different every time. It's like, if you didn't get it this time, I'm going to say it again. It's in every gospel but Mark. So like the master, wow, what a tremendous goal. How can somebody get there? Tom, tell us.
Okay. Well, this has been a big transition for me because it is not only epistemically important, it's pedagogically important. So this idea of apprenticeship, you know, discipleship in Scripture, mathetes, New Testament, its older renderings in the earlier text was always apprenticeship, not disciple, okay? So I'm just saying apprenticeship, what I like about this word, I mean, disciple means follower or student, but apprenticeship is more comprehensive in its nuance, and it's deeply relational. Jesus unpacks this brilliantly, as you alluded to in Matthew 11, 20 through 30, which I think is a core text. Jesus right. says what? Take my yoke and learn from me. It's a training yoke. So what Jesus is modeling is what Michael Polanyi unpacked in Personal Knowledge, which has been more formative to me. It takes, Polanyi corrected the idea of objective propositional knowledge at the expense of personal tacit knowledge that is built in a relationship. In fact, when I first read Personal Knowledge 25 years ago, a chapter on tradition was as close to an epiphany as I've ever seen in my life. Because Polanyi describes what Jesus does. He uses Jesus, but the importance of one-on-one or small group on a master apprenticeship relationship. There are things a person cannot learn or convey apart from relational transfer.
Right. So, I mean, for example, a surgeon, as he does, a surgery, is not only talking about surgery, but the trainees are watching him or her perform the surgery and learn how to do sutures and how to be calm when blood starts spurting. And
yeah,
here's what we do. We stay calm.
So Dan, that's exactly right. In the book, I talk about the scrub sink because I was with a surgeon a couple of years ago in South Carolina who's been training surgeons all his life. He sat right. by me and he said, "Tom, here's the deal. Pastors need scrub sinks." I said, "What do you mean?" This is the most formative thing for surgeons is the scrub sink, right? So I take a group of young surgeons, we scrub up together, we talk about the operation, then we do it, right? Then we come back, we say, "What did we do?" Right. And that's the most transforming. Plus they become close friends, the relational thing. So yes, we need classrooms. I know, Dan, you're a professor. I've done a lot of classrooms. I think they're important, but we need to augment classroom propositional transfer to scrub sink tacit transfer. I think this is hugely important.
Yeah, and I agree with you. In my classes, I teach ethics, and I tell pastors how important it is to take care of yourself physically because the job is emotionally demanding and sedentary, and you skip meals, and then people put rich meals in front of you, and there's all kinds of ways you can go wrong. And I give these lectures, but I also tell students for office hours, we go for a walk. And it's just amazing to me how many students, I had a student, he said, 10 years ago, we went for a walk and I was gasping for breath. He was like 23. He goes, "I went out and got in shape."
What a good Dan.
I've been in shape for 10 years ever since you walked me into the ground when you were, in your 50s and I was in my 20s. And that never would have happened if I'd just given a lecture saying, take care of your body.
Yeah, and you're modeling, we are integral beings. This is Tom Leib. We're integral beings. So one of the things that we do at Made to Flourish, as well as at Christ Community, is we have pastoral residencies, just like a teaching hospital.
Yes, yes.
So, and pastors and leaders, especially pastors, because that's who I work with Made to Flourish across the country, we are establishing residencies like that, right? So when I have residents with me, I'm still a senior pastor at Christ Community. We have four residents who finished their MDiv or THM, come and spend 2 years immersion with that scrub sink. Right. It is remarkably transformational when a pastor goes through a rich residency like that. So I'm pretty passionate about this. And we talk about formation. We talk about their finances, their health, right? Their exercise, their theology. They learn holistically as we work together. It's
well,
awesome.
If I can just say it, I mean, they're going to learn. I'm not trying to be a flatterer, but just to be honest, most people are going to listen to you, not watch you. You know, you've taken care of yourself physically.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look energetic. You come across really energetic with your body language. People can probably hear that in your voice. Yeah. You're not a young man.
And
you've taken care of yourself. And you have a lot of energy still.
Yeah.
And that, of course, you know, being close to the Lord matters more. Chapter 9 is about work and faith. In some ways, it reworks some of your central themes from Work Matters. I'm going to ask you, we kind of covered this chapter to some extent. I'm going to ask you a couple questions. The first one is, in the economic world, business people come up to pastors like you, and I was a pastor for a number of years also, and they say, you know, you need to run the church more like a business. And when pastors hear that, they chafe. You don't understand. It's not a business. You don't charge for your product. People sit in the pew for free. You inculcate generosity and so forth. Are the business people a little bit correct?
You know,
are they
wrong? I think they're very correct, actually. I mean, not fully. I mean, you can take that too far. But I'm saying many pastors, it's like, not only do we have a Sunday to win a gap, we have a gap in understanding economics.
Right.
And for example, so one example, how many pastors know of the halo effect? Like, local churches themselves have a remarkable economic impact on their community. The halo effect is called nonprofit effect, right? So even just the church itself is an economic entity. If it's employing people, buying goods and services, it's an economic actor. And there's economic aspects. A church needs to be run well in terms of its economic life. Now, it's not driving the church in its mission.
Right. Serves the church in its mission very importantly, though.
Absolutely.
If you can't afford staff, how can you, you know?
Yes.
If you can't afford a place to meet, what are you going to do? Meet on the grass? What if it's 90 degrees or 9 degrees?
Yeah, I'm always stunned by government people and 501c3 people like me, right? Nonprofits.
Right.
They forget, at least in our economic system, the only way they can do what they do is because somebody else is making a profit in commerce. So they have money to give. They have capacity to give, right?
Right.
So they should be happy about that. But I think most of it's an ignorance for pastors. They need to go have a workplace visit, learn their business person's space and the importance of what they do, and become teachable. It will be transformational. A workplace visit with your marketplace leaders will change your attitude as you go there to learn from them.
Absolutely right. I consulted with a Christian business, you know, at one point in the past.
Yeah.
And with another friend of mine, you know, like a business leader and I came and were helping a business. They wanted to run their business in a more Christian manner. And after the first visit, we looked at them and said, we need to learn from them. They don't need to learn from us. Now, in the end, we did teach them some things, of course, because they had needs. But I felt that we learned more from them than they did from us, from the experience, as we saw them practicing their faith in their workplace. And they just wanted to go deeper as they did so. But some people think that work is kind of inimical to faith. And one reason why people disjoint Sunday and Monday is because they think maybe they're up to no good. You know, you have to fire people who don't show up and work hard, and you have to push people to meet targets, and you're told you're kind of a brute. And you know what I mean? Like, if you're really gracious, you wouldn't ask me to meet my sales targets, right?
Well, my goodness, I would turn to Matthew 25 and Jesus' parable of talents.
Right.
But no, I'm just saying, I mean, that's part of leadership. It's part of a broken world. It's part of being a good steward. But think about Jesus uses the parable of the talents. I mean, he doesn't just dismiss the one guy who's, you know, puts the one talent in the ground, man. He just, like, he freaks out. I mean, in the parable, right? Like, he's not a nice boss there. I mean, can I use that language? I mean, so I think it's a really blinded way to see it. That's part of our role of stewardship and leadership, is to lead the organizations we do. And one of the things I love about Jim Collins, he makes the distinction. Here's what I'd make the distinction. It's Jim Collins' work. But we have a rigorous culture. We don't have a ruthless one.
Right.
Well, people matter, but sometimes the most important thing you can do is to help a person move on so they can flourish somewhere else where there's a better fit. Again, you treat people with dignity and love and respect as a Christian, but that doesn't mean that you guarantee them a job for life. That's a whole nother thing.
Right. And sometimes people aren't meeting their sales targets because they actually aren't made to be sales people.
Exactly.
And you're not cruel with them, but you say, you know, I notice you just don't care about meeting your targets. Is it because you don't really love this work? And do you know what your skills are? Can I help you find other ways to use the God-given abilities you have?
Yeah. You know, going back, Dan, to your thought, one of the things that encourages me most as a pastor, I've been trying to build this culture at Christ Community with God's help and a phenomenal team for 25 years. But just this weekend, in an elder retreat, one of the younger elders who's launched this very successful business in Kansas City looked at me and said, I've learned more in my leadership training at Christ Community how to run a business than yes. anything else I've ever done. Now, that's not a pat on our back. Part of it's the wisdom of Scripture.
Right.
But it's a leadership culture. He actually sees the church as a value add to him
yes.
in how he runs his business
yes.
and create. Isn't that cool? I'd love that to be the case all the time.
Yeah, so let me ask you to apply that in a way that may be a bit of a challenge. We are living in that age that we call the Great Resignation. Why are people resigning so much, other than fear of unemployment or need to take care of kids because COVID has caused so much disruption? Leave those out of it. What would you say to people who are part of the Great Resignation, understanding some of them are just looking for a better job and so
sure.
forth, but what would you say to people in your church who says, I'm just done. I'm done working.
I think, I don't know if I have any wisdom. I think I'd have some real compassion and empathy at the first point, because I just read the number of CEOs in the Wall Street Journal. CEOs are resigning. I don't think we fully grasp the significance of these 2 years' toll on many leaders. I know that's true of pastors. And I'm not trying to be wimpy here, but none of us have been here before. So I think people are really tired. They're really emotionally spent. They have very little energy. Like if they're in leadership, I can't imagine my healthcare workers right now, right? So I think there is that sense, like, I can't do this anymore. It's almost a burnout. And I think what I would say to people in my parish, it's been really hard. And can you, before you just go, I'm done, can you take 2 weeks off? Can you take three
yes.
and rethink things through a little bit, get a little bit of a clear head? And maybe you should start something new. One of the books that Henry Cloud wrote that I think is really good right now is Necessary Endings. And I think he does a really good job in that book of talking about necessary endings and how they become new beginnings. So that's what I would simply say. Seek the Lord. I wouldn't be impulsive, but I would be empathetic. Like, people are exhausted. Like I've had a couple moments like that transparently, Dan, in the last 2 years around conflict about all kinds of stuff. And I said to my bride, I just can't take this anymore. I mean, I've said that to her. Now, I think I'm doing pretty well right now. So I guess I'd be compassionate, empathetic. If you can take some time out just to recharge and step aside for a little while. But I think maybe some of this is going to mean some new beginnings are going to be creative. God brings great beauty out of hardship.
Yes.
And I think some of this can be beautiful if it's not just motivated for carnal reasons.
So, Tom, are you saying when you refer to necessary endings, taking a break and compassion, are you saying that there is such a thing as, shall we say, excessive loyalty or a foolish kind of loyalty or devotion to a job that you need to be willing to say, you know what, I was faithful here for a while. I have other skills, other opportunities. I should go to that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think some people have an opportunity. Let me just say some
yes.
people don't. Okay, so
right.
I'm really sensitive. A lot of people don't have that luxury just to do whatever jobs. They just don't have that. But if you do have that, that's a blessing. I think a couple things I'd simply say. One is always guard against grass is greener on the other side. Just be careful on that one, right? You can, but I think periodically we should take self-assessment, right? To consider before the Lord and some wise counselors about our current work and vocation, get some good time to reflect. And if we are sensing some new opportunities, I think we need to have the courage to jump into those. Yes. Often we don't because of security. Now, there's nothing wrong with some security, but right? I think sometimes we stay too long because the benefits are too sweet.
Yeah. One of the interviews podcasts I've done is with a man who left a top of the world kind of job. He felt he had to leave it. He started a new business and it failed.
Yeah.
But 10 years after the failure, he says, nonetheless, that failure has been absolutely valuable, transformative, opened so many doors to me, and he didn't live in fear. And God gave him a lot of abilities and a lot of opportunities. But you have to be willing to fail, and I hear you say that, and it's absolutely right. In this section, the same section of the book, chapter 11, you talk about finishing well. And of course, you know, you and I both love 2 Timothy 4, where Paul says, the good fight I fought, the race I finished, the faith I kept. And I say it that way because the emphasis is in the Greek is on the noun. It's the faith I kept and the race I finished. So we're huge fans of that. And you say that the great victories are won in the third period in hockey, or we'd say in the fourth quarter in basketball or football, or we would say in the third or fifth set in tennis. Why do you say a thing like that? What does that mean?
Well, it's coming, first of all, it's coming out of my own experience as a wrestler. Okay, so I'm using the sense that life, right, teaches to number our days. So there's, right, we should have some sense of what our normal lifespan will be, you know. So assuming we have a certain normal 70, 80 years, the scriptures remind us, then it seems to teach us to number our days that we may apply our heart to wisdom. So it should say part of our wisdom is know what season we're in.
Yes.
Right? Kind of where are we in this thing? Trusting God with the brevity of our life. So I was a wrestler for many years. Most intense thing I've ever done. As an elementary student all the way through high school, I was totally intense in the wrestling. So what I learned in the athletic metaphor, and Paul's using athletic metaphor here from Greece, so I'll do the same thing. Can I, right?
Yeah.
Like what I've learned as a teenager has stuck with me as some of the greatest lessons of my life. So in wrestling, if anybody's a wrestler here, if you're a good wrestler and you encounter a social wrestler, you pin them right away, first period.
Right.
If you encounter a good wrestler, you're a great wrestler, you pin him in the second period. If you're a great wrestler and you encounter a great wrestler, you don't pin him at all in the third period. The only way you win is through endurance.
Right.
So what did my coach do? He told me, you got to go out to cross country. I was a terrible cross country runner. I was like a little tank. But I did it all for the third period. And my point is the third period is really the most demanding of all. And it requires the discipline and concentration and teamwork to finish that out. So that metaphor really works for me.
Yeah. And I read that and I thought, you know, he kind of – that. I knew there's something kind of athletic about you, kind of lean, and I thought, oh, okay, that's what it is. You probably wrestled at 115 pounds or something, not that you're 115 now. You're probably a pretty lean guy.
Yeah, I did 105, 120, 138.
Okay, so, all right. I missed your peak, but
close.
Anyway.
Long time ago.
You also have another line that I like a lot, a violinist.
Yeah.
I'm not a performer, I'm a servant. Now, can I just... I want you to elaborate on that, but I also want to say, in the sense in which, of course, that's a false dichotomy, because, I mean, you're in a big church, and I pastor a large church. You have to be somewhat of a performer. I mean, you have to reach row 37, and you have to convey physically, bodily, with your voice, with your hand gestures.
Yeah.
I'm not just mouthing words. I believe in this, and you have to let it show in your body. So there's a, even as the church has an economic aspect, worship, a violinist and a pastor has a performative aspect. Would you agree with that?
I would
never
say,
primary, but it's
I understand the artistry of performance, but here's where I would go, Dan. Here's what I would say: you're always a servant all your life, just like you're always generative all your life. But as your life develops, you are growing in areas of competency. But you have to keep the difference between adequacy and competency. We're never adequate. So when I speak or whatever I'm writing, I keep those two, like, Lord, I steward competency. So yes, right? If you've been speaking and you've been teaching and writing, you should be better at it, right? You should be more skillful. You should be growing. You should be growing in competency. That's a competency. That's a stewardship of your leadership before God. So I'm saying if performance is greater competency, I'm all in, because that's the stewardship. But you're always inadequate. So the difference for me is I remember my audience, I remember my inadequacy, and I continually strive, okay, in the spirit with good feedback, humble feedback from people. How can I do this better? Mm-hmm. And I think that if that's performance, I'm okay with that. If the other pieces are in place, right? That I'm first right. a servant, I preach, speak before audience of one, he's my adequacy. And then, right, I'm going to learn, be teachable. And I have limits. I mean, there are other people more talented than me in some areas, and maybe I'm more talented, right? There's a ceiling, but I continue to try to be better, not for my glory, but for the stewardship of what God's called me to do.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. And I wanted to push you to, I mean, I love what you said and the way you articulated it. We are servants first, but we do pursue competency. What you said about failing and so forth reminded me when I, after a sermon, that maybe a good sermon, you know, like one that was delivered really well and some catchy phrases or whatever, people say, well, you know, at the 14-minute mark, you said David when you meant Saul. And so you had a verbal slip. And I say, my friend, I had at least 15 verbal slips. That's the one you noticed. Run-on sentences, sentence fragments. But we do try to get rid of them as much as we can progressively, and I think we agree on that. We're not indifferent to those errors, but we never think we have to be perfect, because it'll be misery if we aim for a perfect performance. Maybe that's what you're saying.
I approach it a little bit differently. And again, I'm not the most talented, and other people are more talented, but I think we want to grow in our competency right. all our life.
Yeah.
And we don't want to compare ourselves with other people and try to be them, and all that stuff is so toxic. We should cheer our brothers and sisters and people on who are really gifted.
So I want to go to the rapid fire part of things, and I'm going to ask you three rapid fire questions, but I want you to give us an elevator speech about Made to Flourish, which is one of the great faith and work organizations, which you've had the privilege of leading, and you've had wonderful supporters and teamwork and partners. Just tell us a word about Made to Flourish, your faith and work ministry in Kansas City. And not just Kansas City, but anyway, it's
Dan, I'm just thrilled, Dan. Remember we talked about the Sunday to Monday gaps. I'd simply say that our mission is to help empower and equip pastors in their churches to equip their congregations with faith, work, and economic wisdom so that their communities flourish. So we are working with pastors and church leaders to help them connect Sunday to Monday, to help equip them with faith, work, and economic wisdom for the flourishing of their communities. We are a national network. We have lots of resources, a wonderful website. I think we have over 4,000 pastors in the network right now. We do a Common Good Conference. So yes, if people are interested, then go to madetoflourish.org. It's a wonderful organization that's 6 years old. And I've been humbled to be a part of launching that. And I work with a remarkable national team. God is at work trying to help us be more about whole life discipleship. It's nothing more than that, of equipping people for the majority of their life. And we believe a primary work of the church is a church at work. And we're trying to help people really be fruitful servants and apprentices on Monday. And that's why even preaching, because we're about preaching. Preaching is really important. But do we preach not only what the text says, but do we apply it to where people spend the majority of their life?
Yeah. That's madetoflourish.org. And there's a magazine you put out called?
Yes, The Common Good.
Common Good.
Thank you.
And you also do conferences. And what's the name of the conference?
Common Good. It's the Common
That's
Good.
That's easy to remember. That's
We're
great.
Common Good guys.
And you've mentioned the Common Good a number of times. And I know that you and I both believe Common Good includes what we do at work, but also being a good neighbor and inviting people in your home. So if you have a good marriage, you let other people be part of your family in so many ways.
And you know that in Galatians, Paul says, do good to all men, especially the household of faith. Right. I love that, right?
Yeah.
Do good to all.
Yeah, so thank you for that ministry, madetoflourish.org, one more time if anybody wants to check that out. And I should say Work Matters is the introductory book to your work, your views. It shows up in everything you do, but Work Matters is sort of the starting point if you want to know more about your convictions. So let me shift over to four questions. Question number one is, How did you become a good writer? You talked about building your competency, but one thing I like about your writing is that you kind of defy the conventional wisdom. People are either good speakers or good writers. Very few are both. Maybe that's true, but you're a good writer, and I like the way you tell stories. You always make them serve theological points. They're kind of like parables, really. And they're first person, but it doesn't feel egocentric as you write, even about yourself. So I appreciate that. What would you say to a pastor who thinks God wants me to write?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that. And I would say, do what I did with Justin Taylor. You know who Justin Taylor is?
Yeah.
I think after my second book, I asked Justin to read what I'd written. And I looked him in the eye. I said, Justin, you know writing well. And I'm old enough now that I don't need a book to stroke my ego. Or, you know how we get all some of this mixed motivation stuff. I'm going to be somebody, all this stuff.
Right.
And I said, please tell me honestly. So I'm saying, have somebody else that's a good writer that's in it for mission, not their ego or anything else, right, that you trust. But have them look at your writing and ask them the questions. Justin, I said, tell me, Justin, should I write?
He looked
at me and he said, yes. Okay. So I would just say I'd start writing journal articles, write things like that. Just get a little feel, blogs today. But have someone that's a respected person that you really respect. Have someone has some degree of capability through publishing. They've done some
expertise,
work. Yeah.
Reputation, right?
Yeah, and I'm careful how I say that. I'm talking about success and big.
Right.
But I would just simply ask them, would you look at my material and tell me? And if they say yes, then I would say, okay, how do I get better? What should I be doing to pursue this? So I think we need that. Some people are not geared that way. And then another person said to me, it doesn't matter if you publish, it matters if you write. So I would, if you have a heart for write.
Yes.
And don't worry about publishing.
Have to publish it for it to be valuable. You may write something and end up simply doing it at a conference or sharing it with friends. It might be, for example, a lot of people find it very useful to write about a personal tragedy, helps them work through it. By the way, if you do so, write with your hands, not just your fingers on a keyboard, right? It's good to write with your hand when you deal with a tragedy. That's the podcast with Dan Allender. He talks about why that's true. So yeah, you can write and not publish and still have done something very valuable. You and I agree on that. Thanks for making that point.
Yeah.
So a couple questions very quickly. Ready? You are not just a working machine. What do you do for fun? How important is that for you? What's your hobby, your life-giving side interest? What do you do to rebuild the energy?
I've made more progress on that.
Okay.
I haven't always been balanced, but here's things I love to do. I love to turkey hunt. I love to hike in the mountains. Of course, I love to read, but I love to walk with my bride like through the Arboretum. I love being outside. I also love birds. John Stott, who I can never hold a candle to, I love John Stott, but he was a birder.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a birder since I was a kid.
Mm.
So I'd say birding. I love to bird. I'd love to hunt birds, like pheasants and turkeys. I hope nobody's here with PETA. Sometimes I can't talk about that. Like they're not going to like me anymore because I kill a bird. But and then I love to hike in the mountains.
Yeah. I don't know very many wrestlers who are also birders. I have to tell you that.
I'm probably a strange character, Dan. God loves me. I am what I am. What you see is what you get,
I'm not saying it's a bad combination. I'm just saying I haven't encountered it a whole lot. That's all I'm saying. You're one in a million, which can be wonderful. If you could do anything for a year, all practical considerations aside, all obstacles aside, what would you do?
I think I'd do a long hike like the Appalachian Trail or in New Zealand. I'd be out in nature hiking. I'm not exactly sure it would be, but I do a lot of hiking in mountains.
Well, that's something you and I share in common. And I walk a lot with my wife. And in the summertime, we go to Colorado every summer and I hike with my children who demonstrate that I'm getting older every time we go up in the mountains.
Hey, you're with them though. That's cool.
Oh, I'm with them. Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt. I remember the time like 7 years ago, I was with two of my daughters who are very fit and they said, hey, it's just the three of us. It's going to be awesome. Nobody's going to be slow. And I said, honey, if there's three hikers, there's always one who's slower. And this year it's going to be me.
the race is not always to the swift.
No, I was just telling them. I wasn't. I was just informing them that I was slower than they are. That's all I was doing.
You can just say tell them you're gonna have to, you're like a llama. Yeah.
You're gonna have to wait for me sometimes. That's all there is to it. You might have to carry my water bottle even.
I'm glad you're there. Good
for you. Oh, listen, I love it. Last question. What would you like to give thanks for in 5 years?
I think that I finished the race well. Mm. I mean, that's a little serious. I want to give thanks for the Lord, my wife, the blessings I've had. But you know, I think in 5 years, I'll probably be doing something a little different. Mm. I mean, I don't think I'll be gainfully employed as senior pastor or as president of Made to Flourish. I mean, my timetable. So I would give thanks for the years I've had of serving as a pastor and faithful ministry, and I hope I can finish well.
Tom, it's been great to have you. I hope that our listeners enjoy you as much as I have. You really might want to get some of his books, friends, or go to madetoflourish.org and see if you care about this. By the way, you don't have to be a pastor to go visit Made to Flourish. Anybody can do it. A brand new Christian who has a sense, oh my goodness, this is what I was looking for. I have all these pious Christian friends who don't care about my work. I'm so interested. They would be okay to join your organization too,
they
right?
Would. A lot of great resources there.
Yeah, there sure are. So thank you very much, Tom, for your time. Really appreciate your wisdom and your practice both. God bless you.
You too, Dan. Great to be with you.
Thanks again to today's guest, Tom Nelson. I recommend all of his books, especially his most recent one, The Flourishing Pastor. We're giving away copies to a few lucky listeners. A link with more information about that is in the show notes for this episode, or you can visit us at workingwithdan.org. At our website, you can explore archives of old episodes, subscribe to receive updates on new episodes, receive giveaways, and find bonus content. This podcast is a production of the Center for Faith and Work in partnership with the Alliance for Confessing Evangelicals. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And one more time, I'm Dan Doriani, reminding you to work hard, make a difference, and from time to time, take a break.